Here we go, rejecting the screen, the Going ISO edition, as we do every week with all sorts of folks who have touched the NBA. Today's episode brought to you by rockauto.com. Amazing selection, reliably low prices, all the car parts your car will ever need. Noah Kozlov out here on the East Coast. Out West is Adam Stanko. And in the NBA bubble is Cherokee Parks, who's part of the player development department at the NBA, the number 12 overall pick back in 95 out of Duke, 9 years in the league after being a national champion with the Blue Devils in 92 and a McDonald's All-American in 91. And Cherokee, there's so much from your career we want to get to, but when you go through the Duke record books, what really stands out is your record in Anchorman, which was a game off the court, not on the court. So were you really undefeated in Anchorman?
Dude, you only know. See, you got the inside track, man. You got relatives that were there with me. But yeah, we had quite the little. We got a lot of practice in Anchorman, as I'm sure a lot of students do while they're in college. But yeah, when you got your own place, you got a table that you picked out that just happened to be like blessed by the Anchorman gods. You get pretty good at it, but I would say that that it was Nick that actually trained me and got me going. So yeah, definitely got my practice in. I was pretty good at it.
So Adam, my cousin Nick and Cherokee were roommates in college. So I asked Nick, "What can I ask Cherokee off the bat to get him to smile?" and he sent a few things. He sent a few things, and he said, "No, not that. No, not that either." And then he said, "All right, go ask him about Anchorman."
Anchorman, one of those games that just is good in college and stays in college. I cannot think of anything that I would rather not do right now than drink a pitcher of beer, or at least attempt to in one shot. So, yeah, good times, though.
Yeah. Cherokee, before we get into the rest of your Duke stuff, curious, high school, 91, you play in the McDonald's game on the West squad, which I don't even know. Looking back at that roster, you guys were so stacked on the West, ridiculous. You play with four of the Fab Five, Chris Webber, Jalen Rose, Juwan Howard, Jimmy King, and Glenn Robinson. What was that week like in practice, hanging out with those guys? What was that week like for you?
It was great because we didn't collectively come together like most of the elite guys do now. For me growing up in Southern California, I predominantly played in Southern California. I didn't have to go, Long Beach was pretty much maybe out to the Valley, was as far as I needed to play, go to travel to play. So other than Nike camp, which was at Princeton, New Jersey, Sonny Vaccaro was running at the time. Other than Nike camp, we really didn't see each other too often. Out there, maybe Vegas, maybe at Boo Williams out in Virginia, but primarily we would see these guys, just read about them, read about each other in the papers and stuff. So coming together at McDonald's game was still like the first time that we would get together and play. But that game itself was just, it was incredible. I think there was a record number of dunks. There was like 30 something dunks in the game, and just high up and down. We're playing in Springfield, so for us, the national to the Basketball Hall of Fame, getting to go there and check that out. But yeah, and then there was just a lot of talk about, guys, at the time guys would team up and go to schools, and it wasn't so much there was a couple schools that would dominate the recruiting scene. It was, people would just go either locally or they'd find a place to go. And then of course we would not have known at that time that the Fab Five would end up being the four that were there would be the one starting, and that would pretty much dominate the headlines, as far as, young guys in that whole, that whole year. And you would know that years later, that is what some of the elite programs are now, are the Fab Five-esque type teams.
What did you know about Webber before the McDonald's game? And what were your impressions of him that week?
Well, I'd known Chris Webber. We came out for a while. So when I came in, I started playing in eighth grade, and then just kind of rose up, took to the game really well. And then Chris and I were, along with Reggie Manuel, they do USA Today would rate classmen, and Chris, Reggie, and I were the top three freshmen in the country at the time. So Chris Webber came on to, my radar really, really early on when we were playing. And then we were the three freshmen that were invited to Nike camp that year. So yeah, I started playing against Chris when we were 15 years old. So just had always known him through basketball. I got somewhere some great pictures of us from Nike camp back in the day. Chris used to have this high kind of kid and play fade. When you see him, he looks super young. However, you look at his body and he was still a man. Like he was like 6'8", like, God, he must have been 230 pounds, 225, 30 pounds already as a freshman in high school. So he was already pretty dominant. But then the following year, got to know Juwan pretty well. Like he came in and he was at Nike camp as well. I got to know Jalen through Nike camp as well. And then pretty much like we primarily follow players through literature. Like there was whoever the scouting reports were, the Poop Sheet or any kind of publications that came out. Was just how we knew what players were doing and what they were averaging. And, through the Parade All-American teams, it was very old school. Nothing was on video. There was no highlight reels. There was no, obviously, internet or anything to check each other out. So when we came together at those few times that we did, everybody would put their best game, best foot forward, and we'd be trying to play their best. So the game, you can understand the games were pretty intense and a lot of fun.
When you were at Nike camp, who are the guys that you went up against that made you feel like, yeah, I am one of the best in the country. This guy's highly rated and look what I'm doing against him. And then on the flip side, who are the guys that made you feel when you went back home, I got to work harder because that guy's out there?
Nike camp was just loaded. So, when I was coming out, it was like, it was always pitched as the top 120 players in the nation. And at the time, like I just believe that those were the top 120 players in the nation. But coming in for being a big, and I was strictly post player in high school, was the other bigs, like seeing Sean Bradley for the first time. He when I first met him, he was maybe 7'3", 7'4" at the time. Seeing an Eric Montross, who was just like 7 feet tall and already like just had that big body, big feet. Seeing a Luther Wright at the time, another guy that was around 7'2", 250. So for me, it was seeing these big guys for the first time, just going, wow, these are just, because I was tall and skinny. I'm tall and skinny now. I was tall and skinny then. And just seeing these big guys. But then also there was the guys from New York City, man, the Kenny Andersons and the Jamal Mashburns. And, these guys, Adrian Autry, these legendary point guards from New York. And New York was a mystery to me. I'd never visited there at the time, and just hearing about these street ballers and these guys from New York, I was always just enamored by them. And then there was a guy seen like Jimmy Jackson, who already just had like the body of a man playing point guard. He was 6'6", a big guard, just dominating the floor. And then coming in with the young guys, and then Jason Kidd when he showed up, like, he's this kid from Oakland, he's this kid from NoCal. Jay Kidd just came in and just instantly just lit everybody up. So I think everybody would have, there was a lot of basketball, a lot of in-class instruction as well, but I think everybody would have, their moment to shine. But it was just a lot of high-flying, a lot of, big bodies, and that was the thing that I took away from the camp primarily, was how mature physically a lot of guys were, because I still had kind of a baby face and had this kind of waffy kind of beach bob kind of haircut that seemed to piss a lot of people off for some reason. Just kind of this beachy guy, just grew up by the beach and just, and I kind of just like, so seeing these guys that were just kind of from inner cities that just had these big bodies and just were real aggressive, like that was like, wow, that's right. I just knew, I was like, shit, this is like a whole nother level right here. I'm definitely gonna have to get in the weight room and definitely put on a couple LBs before the next level.
Start your morning with the news that matters in just 10 minutes. I do every morning. Axios Today host Nyla Boudou and a team of award-winning journalists will bring you the latest analysis and insight into the trends shaping our world. There are so many makes and models of cars. It is nearly impossible to get all the parts you could ever need in a traditional chain storefront. And these days, who's going into a traditional chain storefront?
Not me.
We've all got computers.
Not me.
So if you got a computer, you got access to rockauto.com. Do it on your phone also, so it's right there in your pocket. Family business serving auto parts customers online for 20 years. So go to rockauto.com to shop for auto and body parts from hundreds of manufacturers. Parts, we say it all the time, parts that I didn't even know existed in a car.
Yes.
You can go to rockauto.com and you can find it there. The catalog is unique. so easy to navigate. You can see all the parts available for your vehicle, choose the brand, specifications, and prices you prefer. Yes, I said you can choose the prices you prefer because the prices at rockauto.com are always reliably low, and the same for the professionals and the do-it-yourselfers. So,
like you.
Why? Yeah, and like you, and like most people I know. So why spend up to twice as much for the same parts? Here's the important part. RockAuto.com right now, write "Locked On" in their "How did you hear about us?" box so that they know we sent you. It helps. Trust us. "Locked On" in their "How did you hear about us?" box. Amazing selection, reliably low prices, all the parts your car will ever need. RockAuto.com.
So Cherokee, it's weird because I feel like now I keep going backwards. It was like, it's like we start at Duke, then go to All-American game. But you mentioned it. You start playing at 14. I know a coach convinced you to play. You were interested in other sports, playing baseball and all. But like, as I was doing the research for this interview, I just kept going in my head. You start playing at 14 years old, and then all of a sudden, 4 years later, you're a McDonald's All-American. So how does like that transition happen? And at what point during that transition are you like, oh, wow, I'm one of the best high school basketball players in the country. This is crazy.
It just came quick. Like I was always an efficient player. I started, like I said, with eighth grade, started playing on a traveling team. And then somewhere like halfway through the season when I was in eighth grade, started getting letters to my junior high school. They're like, hey, you know, first letter came from Mike Montgomery when he was at Stanford. They're like, yeah, you got a letter for Stanford office. And I was just, wow, that's interesting. And it was a letter from Mike just going, hey, check you out. Just want to say, just a general introduction letter. And I was like, well, this is pretty cool. And they just started just coming in from there. And then just as it worked out, going into high school, Mark Jorgensen, who was an outgoing senior who took a scholarship to play for Lute Olson at Arizona, he was exiting, and we had a senior dominant team, and we needed a center. And Coach Steve Popovich just put me on, starting this summer, put me on at starting at center, from the very first game. And so I remember I was just I see Mike Hopkins around, he's Washington, and Mike was a senior on Modern Day. My first high school game was against Modern Day, playing in an outdoor tournament down in San Clemente, California, on the beach. So just give me an idea of when I talk about playing against some of the inner city guys. My first high school game was literally on a court on the beach in San Clemente, and I'm playing against Modern Day, which is obviously a legendary high school program, and obviously in Orange County is a huge program, and I'm playing against Mike Hopkins though, who goes on and plays at Syracuse and coaches at Syracuse, and now he's a head coach, and I see him around and stuff. So. But it kind of just went really, really well for me. Like, so I was an efficient player. I didn't need to have the ball in my hands a lot to score. I loved to rebound and block shots. And just going from my freshman year to my sophomore year, I was the only underclassman on the team. So we completely had a whole new team my sophomore year, which allowed me to really, just step up and be more aggressive. And then I think coming out of my sophomore year, I had a great Nike camp my second year there. I think I was one of the camp leader and rebounders, just really kind of solidified myself at the center spot. And again, I think what attracted a lot of coaches to me was I didn't need to have the ball to score, get a lot of rebounds. I always shot in the high 60s, which is where the kind of Bill Walton comparisons came on earlier on when I was playing, just being SoCal and just, my efficiency with the ball. And then everything just kind of just kept progressing from there. Made the Parade All-American team, first team a couple of times, and just had a good progression every single year, going up through freshman, sophomore, junior, senior. And then boom, you're at the McDonald's game. And then I think at the time we could only do two tournaments. So I did our All-Star games. I did McDonald's and then the Capital Classic at the time. Everything just kind of just, I did USAB after, I did the Olympic Festival after my senior year, and then did my first U19s with USA Basketball at that same time, and then on to Duke, and then right into national championships. Everything just kind of progressed really nicely through that portion of my basketball career.
You win the title your freshman year. Did you ever just stop and think, this is easy?
No, it was just how it was. It was never, I don't remember ever taking time to reflect and really just take a broader look at the process. It was just playing, and you're going to school, and you're growing up, and you're making friends, and you're, you're progressing. And imagine too, because we work with a lot of younger guys now too, through a couple of programs that we have through the NBA. And it's like, you have this freaking long runway. Like, you come in, like, it's like eighth grade going into high school. It's like, man, you got 4 years of high school to work it out like any other student or any other classmate, what you're going to do after, you know, post high school, if you're going to go to college or not, whatever. And, but you got 8 years. And then at that time, when we came out, like, there wasn't a lot of guys that would jump, that would leave college early and commit to the draft. So basically you had this 8 year runway to figure it out, just like any other young person would, just like anybody else going to college and graduating and then introducing himself into the workforce. And so it just kind of went. I don't think it was really till maybe even late in my junior year that I even started thinking about the NBA. It was just kind of basketball and playing, and, you know, just what was going on at the time was what was most important. Stepping in that team that my freshman year, man, that team was just, it was just an amazing team. Obviously a lot of experience, a lot of veterans. A crazy, you know, coach. I don't know what the Final Four run was at that point, but I think they had been like six times or something, or seven times over the last like 9 years or whatever it was. It was some incredible run, Final Four run that Duke was having. And so you was able just to fall in place, and there was already a lane that was established, and you just needed to jump in that lane and just go along for the ride.
Cherokee, where did you watch the 91 national championship from?
91 national championship. I was in a friend of mine from school. We were in San Diego. They had a vacation home or something down there, and we were at a friend of mine, Noli Zoza. I'll give his name, Noli Zoza, and I'm going to say his name because we were down there at his house, and I think Noli ended up being roommates with Fizdale in college. Talk about small world. Like, they ended up connecting a college down in San Diego at some point like that. So we were down there. I remember watching the game, and obviously you had all the talk about the year before when they played UNLV, and I'd already committed in October. So, you know, it was just down there. And I think Eric Meeks from San Diego as well. So I mean, we were watching the game together, but I was down in his area. And I remember just bouncing off the walls. I just was super excited when they were winning that game.
Adam, in your household.
Yeah.
Well, I know the baby's not ordering yet. Hudson's not ordering food, but he's ordering you guys around. And then two teenage girls. Yep, they're making their own decisions. And your wife. So how often do you all agree on, all right, here's what we're going to order for dinner?
Never. Never.
That's why DoorDash is so helpful. Because you can just order from all different places and it all comes right to your door in a hurry. It's that app that brings you food that you're craving right now, right to your door. It's easy. DoorDash app, choose what you want to eat. And then the food is left safely outside your door with the new contactless delivery drop-off setting. And they've got over 300,000 partners in the U.S., Puerto Rico, Canada, Australia. So you can support those local go-tos or the favorite national chains right now. Our listeners can get $5 off and zero delivery fees on their first order of $15 or more. Just download the DoorDash app, enter code LOCKEDONNBA, LOCKED on NBA, LOCKEDONNBA. We're part of the Locked On Podcast Network. $5 off, no delivery fees on your first order. Download the DoorDash app, use the code LOCKEDONNBA for $5 off your first order with DoorDash. You've talked about how difficult it was being with Leitner, especially early on, just not really knowing how to handle him personally. Can you recall any particularly difficult moments where, looking back on it, you think you really grew from it?
All of it in general. Like, Leitner's just you know, as far as the character and things that, you know, people say about Leitner and trying to figure out, he goes to the beat of his own drum. He's Christian. He's at his own pace. He never conformed to anything that you maybe thought that a player of his caliber or somebody that has that through their accomplishments takes there's a spotlight that shines upon him. He just kept being Christian himself. And so coming my freshman year, like, he just knew, man, he knew when he got a thorn in your side, like, he knew how to drive it deep. And that was just something he did. But I think that, you know, that on the floor, that really brought out the best in everybody, because he held everybody accountable, and he was so calm and so cool about the way that he would approach things. But he would, like I said, he would find that little chink in your armor, man. He would just bam, bam. He would just pound at it, and that was tough. I mean, it was tough again because in by nature I'm just a laid back guy, and I'm really chill and I'm non confrontational, and so just having someone kind of grind at you like that sometimes was kind of tough, And he was, to give an example would be like, he was a straight below the rim player, but yet after practice he would want to do like these dunk contests where we had to dunk on each other, and he wasn't a shot blocker or a dunker, but that's what he would want to do after practice. Is we would literally stand at the basket and you would go at the person and try to bang it on him, and you try to block it. So this is again coming from a guy that wasn't his game or his repertoire at all, but that's what he wanted to do. And so that was the kind of stuff that made us better. But yeah, I got to know him through that. And once he graduated, I think we had a better relationship once he got into the league. And he just, he was into skateboarding and music, and he was just a good guy. And just, but just coming that first year, just not knowing what to expect, and then having the team be at the level that it was at. And again, it's like his accomplishments, when you look at what he did through the NCAA tournament, through college. I mean, he really had a flipping unbelievable collegiate career, man. So it's,
he's a top five college player of all time.
Of all time. Like, he has NCAA records that just straight up with how the game is now that will never be beaten. Never.
Like, never. Did you ever knock him on his ass during those dunk contests?
Yeah, I'm sure I got him a few times, because I definitely block shots and I definitely like to dunk. So yeah, I can't give you an exact time, but I'm sure that I absolutely had to have got him a few times. It was his birthday just the other day too. So happy birthday, Late.
I know Grant Hills talked about that stretch and said that he was shocked when Leitner was asking him to do the same thing. Hey, come dunk on me. And he said after a while, like, that stopped real quick after Grant Hill started cramming on him a few times later.
Started cramming on him, but that's what he wanted to do. Like, the guy could rarely get to rim, but that was the competitive nature. That's why when you see him hitting free throws, or you're watching the Kentucky game, you look at his face and it's just stoic, man. It's just like, I got this. He's not worked up. He's completely calm. You can't tell when he's rattled. Like, occasionally you would see him, man, dropping that bomb or something on the court, but that was rare. You know what I mean, he just kind of was like cruising. Like, and when you see him do his work in the post, it's like he's in slow motion. Boom, boom, boom. And just boom, dropping it off. Just repetition, dropping it off. Just efficient and but definitely like success followed him. That was for sure.
I know. I just want to ask about one game in your college career, and it's not the Leitner shot. It's actually your junior season when you guys beat Purdue in the Elite Eight. And you hold Glenn Robinson in check. He goes 6 of 22 that game. And you were terrific. 15 points, 10 boards, 3 blocks. You were calling your teammates Big Dog, riling Glenn Robinson up. What was that like, especially considering the fact that you had known Big Dog long before you guys play in that Elite Eight Classic?
Hey, we had to do what we had to do. So that year, the setup going into it was, we had a good season. We had a really good season, but we were just never like, from my recollection, we were never like the team to beat. You know what I mean? So we did our thing. We had games, a couple of games we lost and we could have won, but we had a good season. We were coming together. Obviously, it was Grant's senior year. It was a team effort. We really needed everybody to win our games. Jeff Cable's on the team with younger guys, and Chris Collins was on the squad, and Antonio Lang. We really had to come together as a team to win games. And so that was a three-man effort, by the way. Okay, so that the game plan was, it was between, Glenn was hot. Like, he was just smoking people all year. He was smoking teams. So we had to come in, and we knew we had to have. So it was myself, Grant, and Tony Lang. And, Tony is coaching with the Cavaliers now. So it was the three of us that had to come together to try to defeat Glenn Robinson. So, yeah, we were in the hotel doing defensive slides in the hallway because Grant was my roommate on the road. So we'd get up, Grant, get up, defensive slides in the room back and forth. They're on the hallway defensive, like, come on, big dog. So we just kept putting one of us in the big dog role. And so when it came game time, that just carried over, and then that ended up what we ended up just saying through the game. So we had to pull, we had our tool belt. We had to dig deep on that one, because Glenn was crushing people. Like, he was playing so well. So, like, we literally had to throw three people at him in order to try to keep him in check. And so, you know, fortunately, we were able to do that.
What was the vibe like on draft night with all you guys there, especially the, I mean, so many ACC guys with Joe Smith and Stack and Sheed, and then you've got KG around?
Yeah, draft was weird. I gotta be honest with you, man. The whole draft and the whole summer, like, you know, my transition out of college into the league was weird. To start with, is that there was the talk of the rookie salary cap was coming in. So this is 1995. So the rumblings that because the CBA was up that summer. So mm-hmm. the rumblings that there was going to be a new rookie salary cap, and this was at a time when, you know, a lot of basketballers remember that salaries and the length of your contract were a big deal. So at this time, you know, and this is what kind of stemmed from the year before, guys were trying to lock in like 8, 9, 10, 12-year deals from the get-go. So the idea was that just having that security, and some guys even didn't even want it out. There was not even outs in their contracts. But the idea was to get as much money as you can for as long as you can. So when they started talking about the rookie salary cap, that in turn, that instigated the whole younger guys starting to come out, you know, freshman, sophomore during that.
Mm-hmm.
So
yep.
At that time, so that's when all these young guys, Antonio McDyess, Stackhouse, Sheed, KG, Gary Trent, like all these guys wanted to come out early at that time. So all that was kind of like what's going on. And the idea was that the rookie salary cap wouldn't be implemented until 96. So they ended up jump ship, and then that's when, again, Kevin Garnett, his name came up in that, hey, there's this high school kid that's going to make the jump as well. So while we're all doing our team workouts and stuff, KG was like, yo, like, you know, yeah, he's definitely going to get drafted. And then after like a couple more weeks, because we're all doing our rounds, working out with teams, you know, you kind of have an idea of where you might fall. So, you know, I was kind of, you know, projected between, there'd be a lottery pick. So I was kind of working out between like the teams between the 3 and 11 picks. And then all of a sudden, a couple weeks would go by, and you'd end up going to a team that KG had just worked out for or was about to work out for, you work out with. And so they were just saying how good his workouts are going. And all of a sudden, it's like, yo, this kid's going to be a first rounder. And then, you know, you go work out with a couple more teams, and then it's like, man, KG's going to be a top 15 pick, man. And then it was like, all of a sudden, it was like, yo, this kid's a high lottery. And so, like, as that's going on, so it's just like, you know, all these young guys coming out, teams are figuring it out. There's all this movement, it seemed, with the players more so with the teams. And then we go up, and then there's the expansion teams, which are Toronto and Vancouver. So we have the draft up in Toronto, and it's in the Dome. So it's this huge, big, cavernous place. And we have the draft, and, you know, Damon Stoudemire ends up going really high, which he'd projected to be a later first rounder. So things got kind of mixed up. And then we all flew to our respective markets the following day. We signed a portion of our contract for our rookie deals, and our rookie deals in 95 were awful. We signed we got a little portion of checks, and then the lockout started the next day. Yep. So the whole summer we were away from our teams. There was no summer league. There was no Salt Lake City, Vegas. None of that was going on. And then we ended up, they ended up striking a 3-year deal, to get the season going on time, like a week before we were supposed to report to camp. So the whole draft, all that was just like a blur, trying to figure out what's up, not being able to work out with your team. And then I got drafted 12 by Dallas, and I had not even worked out with Dallas. So I had no idea what the staff was like or anything. And I just actually had just sat down and was able to get with Keith Grant, who's our assistant GM, just the other day. He's been there since 1980. He's been one of the original members of their staff. I was able to sit down with him and just kind of talk about that whole draft experience and kind of my year there with them and everything. So that was actually pretty cool. But the draft itself was pretty wild. There was a lot happening just on all levels for us coming in that year.
Well, so as you mentioned, your starting rookie season gets delayed. You've been quoted later saying, hey, it was a nightmare. You're getting DNPs for the first time in your life. But there was this shining moment. You're playing with Jason Kidd, Mashburn, Jim Jackson, George McLeod, but there's this great moment. 16 games in, December 23rd, you go for 15, 8 rebounds and 5 blocks against the T-Wolves with Leitner and Garnett. What are your memories of having your first big night in the NBA?
It was good. You're right. It was Dick Motta was the coach, and I'd heard coming in that he was just notoriously not even, I wouldn't say tough on rookies. He just didn't play rookies. It just wasn't his thing. And I was actually able to confirm that with, I'd heard similar stories to kind of like how he coached myself about Detlef Schrempf. And I was able when I saw Detlef, I goes, hey man, I was able to drop a few things. And he was like, yep, that was my experience. Exactly. So it was good coming in because KG just, again, like he just kept shining. When you see those pictures of KD, like, and again, this is like, we have all these teams now that have a lot of young guys that are 19, 20, 21. When you see, we find pictures of KD when he's a rookie, and it's like everybody else is 5 or 6 years older than he is. So he looks like he's 18 years old. Man. Mm-hmm. He looks very young. But, getting to go up in there and getting to play them up there and have a good game and get on the floor. And then obviously, with Late and all those guys up there was just was pretty cool. Was pretty cool. But I was good. I think at the time I was just like to get up on the court. I literally did not know. Most of the time it was a DNP or maybe a couple minutes, but I literally had no idea what to expect as far as where I would be in the rotation for any given night. Like there was no consistency in that at all. So yeah, I was pretty psyched anytime I can get into double digits.
Off the court, how'd you get that no fear deal?
No, there wasn't. Yeah, it wasn't even no fear deal. It was. They were based on California. It was, for those who remember, no fear was like a big brand at the time, kind of coming around at the same time like N1 was coming out. And I had a connection, or a friend through a friend in California, and I had a friend who drew a picture of me that we were going to put on some shirts for. Because we do barnstorming. Once you finish your senior year in North Carolina, you go out and do some barnstorming with some NC State guys and UNC guys and Wake Forest guys, and you go play games at various gyms and various communities throughout North Carolina. And they had sent me the shirts, and some of they put No Fear had ended up making the shirts, and then which I wasn't able to use because they also put Duke on the back of the shirt as well.
Oh yeah.
But that just kind of ended up coming together. But I don't know, but my mom actually has one of those shirts. So when I see her, I'll see if I can get a photo and I'll send it to you guys.
I have one.
Oh my god, it's got me dunking wearing a headdress.
Yeah,
I don't
exactly.
even know if that would probably maybe get raise a few eyebrows now. But at the time, it was cool. It was an illustration. But no fear. That kind of brings people, a few people back to the 90s. It's kind of their age.
When were you happiest playing in the league?
League was toughest, man. I think my most enjoyable times, definitely was up at Minnesota. We get up there. We just had a good group of players. It just started anytime, if I was enjoying myself or not, it depended on where my head was at.
Right.
Played for a lot of good organizations, a lot of times where teams were transitioning, but ultimately depending on where my head was at. But with that being said, Minnesota was great because we were young squad. Flip Saunders was our coach. Kevin McHale's in the head office. Jerry Ceesings was an assistant. Terry Porter was on the squad. Randy Whitman was one of our assistants. We made the playoffs for the first time. Stephon Marbury was a rookie. It was a lot of fun. We were growing. The community was really excited about the progress the team was making. We had a good – Tom Gugliotta was on the squad. Doug West. Mm-hmm. We just had a good – Sam Mitchell. A lot of guys went on to coach. We just had a good group of players that we could – that the team could build with. And then we were able to, build on the second year right there. But then after the second year, that had been my third year, is when we went back into a lockout again that ended up extending through till 99. So that was where the rookie salary, all that stuff just kind of got did not work out. Everything just got kind of changed around. So that was some good times though when I was with the team. And then when I was playing with the Clippers, we had a good young team. It's when Corey Maggette was on the squad, and Keon Dooling and Darius Miles and Quentin Richardson and Lamar Odom. We just had a good young squad. And Sean Rooks was our vet, and Pajkowski was a vet. And Jeff McGinnis was at point guard. And Alvin Gentry was coaching, and Dennis Johnson was the assistant coach. Was great. And Rex Kalamian, who's now back with the Clippers again, was our other assistant. John Hammonds, who's the GM with Orlando now, was an assistant for us. And And we were practicing at Southwest College in Inglewood at a junior college is where our practice court was at. But we had a good young team. It was one of those, again, before the way the teams are structured now, like we were the youngest team in the league and, you know, coach was throwing out different lineups every night and it was fun and a lot of energy and we were, you know, trying to get it done, but transitioned to the Staples Center for the first time. And it was just great. It was just a lot of fun. I was back in California and, just playing time was good and it was fun playing in LA and there's just all this glitz and glamour stuff going on. And that was another good time. And then just through them, like a lot of situations that I was in with basketball were changing coaches or maybe selling the team or, you know, executive changes or redoing the roster, trading people off. So there was just a lot of, I was in a lot of volatile situations, which was definitely, you know, stability is where I needed to be at. And I just kind of found myself, other than when I was in San Antonio, was in a situation where a lot of things were in flux. Like, for example, I went to Miami for training camp. Pat Riley comes in and retires while we're down there. That just gives you an example of kind of this kind of situations I was in.
When you're in Miami, you play with a rookie, Dwayne Wade. You play a couple preseason games there. What was it like to play with Dwayne Wade at that time?
It was fantastic. We'll just go in there. Lamar was down the first time, and then they had Brian Grant and of course Eddie Jones, the backdoor specialist, was there. And yeah, D Wade was coming in. That was before we knew that D Wade would be D Wade. And watching Udonis Haslam, like he was at training camp that year. That was his first year. And I see that, and I'm like, oh, holy crap, the dude's still, I'm still watching that right now. And then, Stan Van Gundy was one of the assistants, and, Pat was very by the book with everything, and just so we went through training camp, and it was, very rigid, very structured, exactly, the type of environment that would be best for me, he would come out at 9 o'clock on the button. We would come out for practice. It was at 9 or 9:30, but on the dot, he would walk out of this door into the practice facility. And one practice, one morning, he just didn't walk out. And then, I don't know if it was Stan, someone came up, they're like, yo, coach wants to talk to you guys in the locker room. And, we went down into the locker room and Pat came in and spoke for a good while, maybe 45 minutes or an hour, or I don't know if he didn't start right away. And he said he was going to retire. Everybody was just kind of like, what? Like, I don't know if anybody knew on the team. I mean, I certainly did not know that's what he was planning on doing. And he retired. They're right down the spot. And Stan took over responsibilities for the rest of training camp. So it was pretty wild. It was pretty wild.
You said that the most stable situation was San Antonio, where you were in 2001-2002 playing the Lakers in the Western Conference Finals. You led, the team led in the fourth quarter, or going into the fourth quarter in all five games, and lost the series 4-1. Should you guys won the series?
I don't know. Lakers were tough. There was a lot going on at that time. I think if all cylinders were clicking for us, that we were definitely in a position to take that series. Tim Duncan had a death in the family when playoffs had started. David Robinson's back had been ailing him all season and just primarily during the playoffs and just really ticked up. So, I think all things considering that just, it would have been an uphill challenge the whole time for us to get through that. However, that's sports. But I think with the healthy roster that we definitely had an opportunity to take that series.
Duncan was so dominant during that season, MVP season. You're getting to watch him every day. For those watching from afar, just explain the appreciation, what it's like to play alongside, what this guy does on a daily basis.
Dude, he is cool, calm, quiet, collected. Like, that is Tim Duncan. Like, he makes the game look so easy. Like, you watch him and you're just kind of like, man, it makes whoever's guarding him or playing against him, like, he's so effortless, in my POV, like, he's so effortless. He looks like he's putting in, like, it's just happening, that it makes it look like the defense really isn't trying that hard. When all the while, you're busting your ass to try to block those shots, those turnaround jumpers, trying to catch that before he can hit it off the glass, and you just can't get it done. But Tim, I go back to Wake Forest, man, he's been tormenting me since college. Like, he was one of those guys that people just say, man, like, who is the guy to play against this tough? I go, Tim Duncan. Because I've been getting a shot off over that guy, man. And whatever his offensive prowess was, and that's when we see him in the post and all that stuff, man. I mean, he was a tremendous shot blocker. Tremendous shot blocker. So I had him 2 years. He played against him at Wake Forest, where it was just like, Jesus Christ, and this guy, Tim Duncan, man. It was just like, he completely would alter your offensive game with his defense. I mean, he was a phenomenal, again, just a quiet guy. You need to, when you see a few times, a few clips of him yelling and getting animated, that was very, very rare. And in practice, I didn't see that ever. He just came and did his work every day. He was just a quiet guy and just got his work done. And where I really saw him, though, where I just knew personally where that he was going to be an exceptional player forever, was we played in the 94, we played in the Goodwill Games over, and we went to St. Petersburg, Russia. So we had got together. George Riley was the coach, and we had a great team with Dee Stodd, Mike Finley, Sean Respert, and Andrew Clark, and Tim Duncan was on that squad. So we got together to practice. We went to St. Petersburg. We played over there, and then we flew from Russia to Oakland, and we played Dream Team 2. And we played Dream Team 2 at the Oakland Coliseum, and Tim Duncan just went to work. Like, and you had Dream Team 2. That's like, they took all the bigs, but Shaq was one of the bigs.
Yep.
Alonzo was one of the bigs. Was maybe like Derek Coleman on that squad, maybe?
Yeah.
I think Coleman might have been.
Yeah. There were some dominant big guys on that team, and Tim Duncan went to work. He just was like, straight up, like, it didn't matter who. At that point, I was like, it doesn't matter who you put him on the floor with. His game won't change. He's going to do the same things that he does well against anybody. And that's when I saw that for the first time. I was like, oh, this guy's incredible.
What is dinner with KG like versus dinner with Duncan?
I don't know. There wouldn't be dinner with either one of them.
Oh.
That's what it'd be like. KG was pretty much like, he didn't, like, because he was young. So I played with him like he wasn't even 21. So like when he could go out, I came in the league. I turned 23 my early in my rookie year. So like when we would go do stuff on the road, he couldn't do anything on the road. So he was still just, he would kind of hang out in his room and just kind of stay back. And then with Tim Duncan, he's a huge, I don't know if he still is, but he was a huge gamer at the time. So for him, it was like, man, let's get some get a couple, 2 liters of Pepsi or something and go play some video games. You know what I mean? So
Nintendo.
Guys at the time, yeah. And they weren't out on the road type guys. So I couldn't tell you about either one of those two guys. I just can't give you nightmare stories about all the core of them just dropping numbers.
they did plenty of that.
All the time, man. That tenacity, that look he had on his face was just like, God, that's just solidified, I think, in people's mind. His commitment, like out there, his passion. Just like pumping his chest was it. And then Tim Duncan would have been the exact opposite. You know what I mean? He had kind of a Paul Pierce, just kind of boom, this is it. I'm not going to show you anything what's underneath the veil. This is my face. And just all of a sudden it's like, oh crap, he's got 30, 23 rebounds and 7 block shots and 5 assists. It's like, Jesus, dude. Like, really? and then after the game, he's like, what are you, not even pumped about it. You know what I mean? He's just like, yeah, what do you expect? It's what I do.
How did your Fun Police commercial come about with KG?
Yeah, well, you can look at my numbers. I think Nike was obligated to, or I needed to do something through my Nike contract at the time. So the Fun Police was just that series of commercials that KG was the kind of head of Fun Police. And it was him and Gugliotta, and then Bug, KG's boy, was another one of the guys in Fun Police. Maybe just have different people from different teams. I think maybe Gary Payton maybe did one as well. So I was actually the guy that was not having fun on the court, and they were trying to get me pumped up and get me going. So, it was a long day. If I showed you the filming location of where that was shot, you would just be shocked. It was in these old mining caves in Minneapolis that were like left over from like 100 years ago or something. And it was at the back of this like super dense, like moisty back end of a cave that had been some kind of like also some kind of gangster hangout during the 20s. And it was just bizarre. And we did it all day, and then we just sat there to get this little thing, to get this little commercial together. So it was pretty cool. Awesome. That was my, I guess, my Hollywood highlight right there. Was that
awesome.
Search. I think it was through a Nike obligation that I had to be thrown in there.
Being in the player development department now with the NBA, and as you've worked through the associate program and part of the league office, what do you eventually want to be doing?
This is where I'm at right now. I like where we're at. I've been, again, like I said, went through a couple programs offered to former players at the league office, and was able to find a place for me in player development, which is, you know, we work, you know, helping guys to transition into the league. We start with, you know, from combines to helping guys at draft to summer league to the rookie transition program. And then as the season gets going, we work with the team, we work with the union, to help educate guys on, you know, to further understand whether it's continuing education, exploring outside interest, amplifying anything maybe that they're doing off the court, to understanding their benefits, their health, how the player assistance program works, their post-career annuities, their 401ks, and then working through, like, you know, helping them understand and explore avenues as they start working through their career, developing exit strategies and kind of what that next step may look like. And then through some of the program we've been doing now, we work with USA Basketball and their junior national team members and their families, and we're able to bring a similar type of education to them as well. So there's, as we talked about a little earlier, I had an 8-year runway, you know, to consider what was my next step, which is mm-hmm. every high school, college student's runway, whether you play sports or not. These kids come in now, if you're a hot 8th grader or a 9th grader, like, that runway now is a couple years. Like, you got to maybe even by the time you're a junior in high school, start making some serious thoughts about what you're going to be doing after your senior year. Because, again, the G League has the select path now, which is really come open and really come into play this year. But G League's always been open to 18-year-olds. So you can graduate in high school and go right into the G League. But now the G League unionizing and the things that they're doing with that league, we're definitely going to see, you know, I think we're going to see that be a destination for a lot of players. And then also, you know, and now coming in, with the one done, some of the top guys even just doing 1 year of college. That runway now is like you're looking at maybe a couple years. So we've been able to start working with some of these younger guys as well. So a lot of this is happening now, a lot with the social justice movement. You know, there's another areas that we work in and helping amplify guys, different whether programs they work with or you know, helping, you know, amplify their voices in their communities. And so it's just been growing. So I think this is a great area for me right now. Of course, I'm down here in the bubble. Been here since June. I'll be here through October. And right now we're preparing for the families and the friends of the families to come in and the onboarding process and what that's going to look like. And again, just providing player services. So this is great. There's been a lot of growth. So right now, I know there's a lot of areas where this where player development is still expanding. So I like this area that I work with now. The group I work with is fantastic. We're a part of a larger group, which is social responsibility and player programs at the NBA. It's just there's a lot happening, a lot developing at this time right now. So this is a really good place. I really, really enjoy my position, my work at the NBA.
I know you deal with, as you mentioned, some of the families and all of the kids coming up, and that runway is short. Of the kids you've seen, not just maybe in terms of their basketball ability, but just also the kind of person they are, their work ethic, who's the next great one?
It's tough to tell. I can't, just with how things are just have changed up right now and how people get ahead and how guys are drafted and, you know, where they're going to land at. And just knowing the difference in a player, an experience a player could have depending on what team that he's drafted mm-hmm. by and where that team's at. I couldn't tell you, man. And you got guys like Amani Bates, who is who everybody says he's the guy. And, through some of the programs that we work with, like, I just see him a little bit, some of the Nike Elite 100 camp. And then also got to see him play a little bit at EYBL. He's got, like, just watch him shoot around. He'll go out there and just start putting up shots. And he's just ding, 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 just hitting bucket after bucket after bucket. He's just long, and he's just a narrow guy. He's got a great build. Cade Cunningham, who's going down there, he's going to be at Oklahoma mm-hmm. State this year. Again, seeing yep. what these guys, I don't know what their year's going to look like. Like,
right.
Are they playing or not?
Yeah.
Like, what kind of development these guys are going to have? It's really hard, I think, to assess where guys are going to be at come draft time next year. So, but he's just got a great body, just a nice, a big build. And then you got like an Evan Mobley, who's going to be playing over at USC. And he's, again, tall, lanky, big inside guy, all up in the rim, shot blocker. I couldn't tell you right there. My crystal ball, it's kind of hazy right now.
Man, it's got to be pretty wild to see Gary Trent Jr. there, given that his father was taking one pick before you. I'm sure that's making you feel
and then he's here, all young. Of a sudden, it's like, boom, you guys come in and out. Like, you know, guys get starting out, and they're in and out of the G League, and now you find your time, and he just came in. He's just like bubble magic.
Right,
he's just in
right.
Stroking threes and on fire. It's like any day, and it's just a testament that every day you get up and get in your, and you be ready, you get yourself ready, you do the things, because every day could be your day, you know. And this is he's a perfect example right now. He came and he's just lighting it up, and it's like, wow, you know what I mean? So it's just like, you always got to be ready to go, because tonight could be your night, man. This could be where something special happens. So you know, and he's a great kid. So that's another good thing, is just, I could say across the board, just we you know, basketball, the NBA, a lot of the younger guys we work with USAB and the junior national team program are just, they're just great guys. They're just great
young kids, they're just
good people, and they make it a lot of fun to work with them, you know? So that's definitely, you know, really nice, because you could be dealing with a lot of egos, or, you know, just kind of issues, or just kind of, you know, just kind of, you know, inflated. I'm better than I really am. We just don't get a lot of that. You know, a lot of guys are just really good guys, and they got good people around them. So that's definitely great.
Our last question, as always, since it's the Rejecting the Screen podcast, take a teammate, any team that you've ever been on at any level of basketball, need a bucket, end a game situation. Who are you choosing to reject the screen, go ISO, and get that bucket?
He's first, obvious. I don't have to say, who do you think it is?
Christian.
Tim Duncan.
Christian, absolutely. Absolutely, Christian Leiter.
Yeah.
But I got to say, second on that would be, this is what happens when you play on, like, basically a different team every year in the league. I got to go, and that's going to be a J. Kidd. Because J. Kidd's going to get you the bucket, or he's going to get you the assist. You know, one of the two, he's either going to get the shot or he's going to set somebody else up for the shot. I mean, that's a shoe. Jamal Mashburn. I mean, he was – his game, like the way he would just get it, that just his cool, his calmness was just like – he was just electrifying right there. But I'm going to have to go with Christian. I don't want to go too deep on it. I'm going to have to go with Christian. And then next on that, I'd have to say J. Kidd.
Smart. And we'll try to make sure that he knows that you said so.
I see him around. He's around here too. He's just like a couple hotels. He's just like a couple little hotels over. So I'll see him around.
It's one big Duke reunion at the NBA. Cherokee, we really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
All right, appreciate you guys. Thank you.
You can go online and read about all sorts of things that Cherokee was going through during his career and his battles with depression. Mm-hmm. But what I appreciate so much is that he's so positive now and forward thinking, and he can look back on his career and talk about the positive moments and even reflect on some of the down times and the turbulent times with getting drafted during a lockout, then another lockout. And then, as he said, with coaches leaving and then getting traded and joining all these teams and Pat Riley retiring before a practice, and just added to the list. But the league is really lucky to have Cherokee being part of it.
Over and over and over again, as I was researching interviews and reading articles about how he came up through the league and what he's doing now, over and over again, they just talked about the kind of person that Cherokee Parks is and just how everyone can relate to him. He finds a way to connect. And obviously, it's so needed, because we think about the guys that have success and it's great. And yes, he had success early. And like you said, everything seemed easy. It was picks up the game at 14. He's Parade All-American. Then he's a McDonald's All-American. He's a Duke and winning national championships, lottery pick. But all of a sudden, you know, guys hit rough patches, and he certainly did, and for reasons beyond his control. And the fact that he's now able to relate to these guys in the league now and help them out along their journey when things aren't going so smoothly, what a gift for the league to have Cherokee Parks in their ear.
And as always, ton of stuff left on the cutting room floor. But that's the way it goes when you talk to former NBA players. There's just so many stories to tell. Check out everything else on the Locked On Podcast Network, Locked On NBA 5 days a week, Hollinger and Duncan with John Hollinger and Nate Duncan, Locked On Fantasy Hoops with Josh Lloyd, Chad Ford's NBA Big Board, and your team every day on the Locked On Podcast Network. Today's episode brought to you by rockauto.com. Amazing selection, reliably low prices, all the parts your car will ever need. rockauto.com. We're on Instagram at rejecting_the_screen. Adam's on Twitter at NaismithLives. I'm at Noah Kozlov, COSLOV. Adam, thanks, pal.
You are the best.